Welcome to Let's Talk Death, conversations to inform and inspire. Let's Talk Death is being brought to you by Heal Grief, a nonprofit providing the tools and resources to support one's journey with grief. We seek to empower individuals to achieve a healthy post-bereavement growth. Everything we do is inspired by our core belief that no one should ever grieve alone. Let's Talk Death is a series of conversations with some amazing people from various fields. Our goal through these conversations is to normalize, educate, and demystify the taboo around death, dying, and the journey of grief. Hello, welcome to this episode of Let's Talk Death. I'm Fran Solomon.
And I'm Andy McNeil.
And we are thrilled to be your host for these conversations.
Our guest today is Ken is a professor emeritus at the Graduate School of the College of New Rochelle and senior consultant to the Hospice Foundation of America. He is one of the authors of the text, Dying and Death, Life and Living. A prolific author of dozens of books, Ken has published over 100 articles and chapters and is the editor to both Omega, the Journal of Death and Dying, and Journeys, a newsletter to help in bereavement. Ken is also has an ongoing blog in Psychology Today entitled Good Morning. Ken has served on numerous boards, received numerous awards, and has keynoted conferences throughout North America, Europe, Asia, Australia, and New Zealand. He participates in the annual Hospice Foundation of America teleconference and has appeared on CNN and Nightline. Ken has served as a consultant to medical, nursing, funeral service, hospice organizations, educational and social service agencies, and businesses too. Ken is an ordained Lutheran minister, and I would say above all else, Ken is a wonderful friend and colleague to so many in this field, and his work has educated so many people in this work and the support that he's provided. And I will say he has been an educator to me throughout my years. And I am just delighted, Ken, to have you as a guest on our show.
Andy and Fran, I'm delighted to be here today. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course. So, Ken, before we get into your great work, I'd like to ask if there's been a death loss in your life that has shaped the path to your career.
Very definitely, but not a direct loss. It's a kind of interesting story. My son often teases me, you know, when I was 10 years old, did I say I wanted to be a thanatologist when people asked me what I wanted to be? And the answer was no. And when I was doing my degree in clinical sociology, I was really interested in delinquency, and that's what I really wanted to go into. And I had the perfect internship plan. I was going to come back to New York. I was studying at St. Louis, but it was over the summer. I was going to do it at the Spofford Center, and Spofford Center is where New York holds its juvenile delinquents that can't be released at, you know, to their parents for one reason or another, usually because of the chaos in the home or the seriousness of the crime. So it's kind of like the creme de creme of delinquency, you might say. And it was a perfect internship for me, at least I thought. And about a week before I was planning to go out there to return for the summer, I got a letter saying from the supervisor saying, guess what? I've changed my position. I'm no longer at Spofford Center. And you have a choice of coming into me to Sloan Kettering, which is a major cancer hospital, or being released from your obligation. Well, at that point in time, much as I had no interest in going to Sloan Kettering, it made absolutely no sense to be released from my obligation because my whole school program was based on taking the internship during the summer. So I kind of thought, well, at least I'll get a chance to work with adults. At least they'll give me a different experience. And then when I got there, he said, you're just the person we need for adolescents and pediatric units. So I ended up working with children and adolescents who were dying of cancer. Mm-hmm. And that really was an incredible experience. Very uncomfortable in the beginning, but then ultimately after you got beyond the you know, the amputations and the bloating and, you know, and the emancipation of the children, the lack, you know, the hair loss because of chemotherapy, you began to see, you know, these people as real people, as the real people they were. And I got very close to a lot of them. And it really became a change in my career. From that point on, and that was in 1972, I was in the field. That was, 1971, 1972.
Wow. Ken, that's... Thank you for sharing that. It makes me think. I've often said sometimes best laid plans. Life kind of chooses us, and we find ourselves not only doing something, but encountering something that shapes the rest of our lives.
If you would have asked me this the year before I started, I would have said I have no interest. But it's been a 50-year trip for me now.
And what a career.
Well, Ken, obviously you've written extensively over the years and just have so many experiences that we certainly could have conversations about and talk about. I am curious, though, from you, if you were just to think about, are there things that I guess in different parts of your career that maybe surprised you about the kind of work that you're doing or that stand out just in your mind about some of the work that you've been able to accomplish?
Well, you know, one of the things I've told my students when I was teaching them and they were graduate students was that every concept has a biography. Every concept has a story behind it. And so, for example, my work in disenfranchised grief was started by one of my students. We were talking, it wasn't even my grief counseling class. It was a class on the aged family. And we were talking about widowhood. And this woman turned to me and said, if you think widows have it tough, you ought to see what happens when your ex-spouse dies. And I had honestly never thought about that. And so I asked her if she wanted to share, and she did. And then I did a study on the grief of ex-spouses. And then I thought, well, that's interesting. What about the other side of the coin? What about if you're involved in an affair? Well, you can imagine that's a hard sample to find.
Did you put it on the paper?
So I ended up broadening it to people who are involved in intimate dyadic relationships without benefit of marriage. So it included gay and straight couples, couples who did have, individuals who were in an extramarital affair, but others who were just dating for a long time or lived together but not married. And that's where the concept of disenfranchised grief came through, because as I shared this research, people began to say to me, this is like when my high school coach died, or this is like when this, and it began to open up to me a whole lot of areas where people have a significant loss, sometimes a death loss, sometimes a non-death loss, but don't have an opportunity to mourn that loss. It was interesting when I was doing the study on ex-spouses, and this was in the early 1980s, one of the things that struck me is if you look for grief and divorce, in one of those indices, I don't know if you remember using indices before we could Google things, but there were actually books that you could find articles in, listings of articles. And as I was looking at those indices and you looked at grief and divorce, you found nothing. You found stuff on the psychological sequelae of divorce, but nothing specifically that mentioned grief. Yet when I spoke to these women, mostly women, there was one man in my sample, they all talked about the fact that they compared the grief of the loss, the death of their spouse, to the grief of their divorce. So that opened up to me that, there are lots of, and of course, we should have learned that from Freud a century ago. The opening article, what I always considered to be the modern study of death, goes back to 1919, where Freud talks about mourning and melancholia, trying to differentiate grief and depression, something we're still struggling with. And he always started with the case. It was interesting that his case was a bride abandoned at the altar as an example of mourning. And I think he was really trying to, I think he was specifically trying to say, it's not just about death. Took us a long time to learn that, but I think we're learning that now.
Yeah, grief can be a multitude of different things.
Yeah, any loss.
Yeah, for sure. A loss of a job, loss of a home.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of losses.
And we're living in the midst of it at the moment.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, with loss of normalcy. Normalcy
the trauma of an assumptive world,
Let's Talk Death is being brought to you by Heal Grief, a 501c3. As a nonprofit, we are reliant on the kind generosity of our donors. If you are inspired by our mission, we ask you to go to healgrief.org/donations to help us continue our great work. No gift is too small.
You mentioned something about in disenfranchised grief. You mentioned LGBTQ or that community, and I just want to add to that. There's also that loss in that community of perhaps being the grieving the connections that they can no longer have with their family. And then when a family member might die, it's almost like that double grief there. Yeah. There are so many layers is what I'm getting to one's mm-hmm. grief that just continue to grow and grow.
I think that's very true.
Yeah, very difficult. You also talk, I think it's in your Grief is a Journey book. That's where you talk about this disenfranchised grief. But you also talk about losses that might be stigmatized. Death by suicide, or from disease, or maybe even an LGBTQ grief. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Some deaths we look at differently. For example, if I were to say to you, I just went to the funeral of a good friend who died from lung cancer, what would be the first thing you'd probably say? Did he smoke? Did she smoke?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It shows that even in these kinds of death, there's a sense of stigma. You know, one of the things that drove me crazy during the early years of the HIV AIDS crisis was I did some work with pediatric AIDS, and I used to hate the expression, the innocent victims. They were the innocent victims of the disease. You know, because to my notion, everyone's an innocent victim, you know, but you began to see the sense of stigma. Probably one of the ones we don't talk about as much, which we really should, is for example, homicide. Here's a cheery statistic. You have an 80% chance of being killed by somebody you love and know. Stranger homicides are relatively rare. And you know, and what that often means is that you're mourning both the victim and the perpetrator.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it really is interesting to see how certain kinds of deaths for multitudes of reasons are often stigmatized. And again, you know, one of the stories I tell in Disenfranchised Grief is about a woman who came to me and said her son had died, adolescent son, or late adolescent son, young adult. And she said, I don't even know how to answer the question, how did he die? I said, because he died perpetrating a robbery. And, you know, and so the first thing you say, he was shot during a robbery. And the next thing that people say is, I hope they got the guy. And, you know, and he was the guy, you know. So, you know, how do you struggle with that?
Interesting.
I'm also curious about what are you working on these days? Are there things, you know, what has your attention?
I just finished a book called When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End. And that was kind of fun to do, interesting to do, because it really talks about all the sort of unusual events around death and dying. You know, the near-death experiences, the nearing death awareness, the terminal lucidity, and, you know, even just all the coincidences. It was probably the book that I was most fascinated in writing, you know, because sometimes writing can be difficult. This book seemed to just write itself. And it was fascinating, you know, even just some of the coincidences. Just to give you an example from the book, Robert Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's son, was a young college student. He was being pushed into a crowd, into an oncoming train, you know, as the crush of the crowd. And a hand reached out and pulled him back sharply. And as soon as he looked at the owner of that hand, he recognized him as the famous actor Edwin Booth. Subsequently, Edwin Booth's brother would assassinate Todd's father.
Wow.
Then, you know, just another example of his life. He was present at all three assassinations in the 19th, you know, at Lincoln's, at Garfield's, at McKinley. Turned down an invitation by Teddy Roosevelt saying, bad things happen when I'm around presidents.
Wow. You know, one of the things I've appreciated, among many things, Ken, over the years for you, and I have to say, and I know, like, I grew up on you in the sense that I as I came into this field, there were very particular people who helped shape my view in this field. And one of the things that I've appreciated, I think, more than anything, I believe, is your sociology type of approach of observing these things and cataloging and putting them into one place where people can easily digest it and connect with it. I know the Living with Grief series with Hospice Foundation of America. Yeah. That I would, you know, attend every year virtually, and the books that accompanied that, the edited books that accompanied it. And again, had this subject matter in one place, and the gift that was to so many, not just me, but to so many in the field.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I am curious a little bit behind that. Like how did you all conceive of that and where that sort of came from?
Oh, well, interestingly, a number of years ago, two men, one of whom is still alive. Norman Sherman was the vice president of the Hospice Foundation, and Jack Gordon was the president. And they were they had gotten a legacy of money to help hospice. The source of the contribution was, I think, VITAS, a hospice organization. But they wanted to do something to help the hospice community. And they were casting around trying to say what really works. And they went to a NHPCO meeting. And as they sat there, they said, you know, this is great. It's good information. But how many people work in hospice? And maybe 500 people are here. So they decided to do a teleconference. It was going to be one program. And they thought, well, maybe we'll get 1,000 people. And, you know, and that'll be twice as much as you can get at a conference. It turned out that our conferences now go into the, you know, anywhere from 5,000 to 20,000 viewers. And probably more as people view it after the event. And so it became a kind of education. And when they did that, they invited a number of people to come in and kind of plan that. And I was one of the people. I was president of ADEC at the time, so I was one of the people they invited. And then they asked me to stay on. They found my ideas useful. And then the next year, we put out our first book. The first year we didn't, but the second year we did, called Morning Children, Children Morning.
I remember that one. Yeah. It's fascinating to me. And I think also just the connection to so many people now are all of a sudden shifting and using technology, right? Because we have to. But how far ahead HFA was.
And that's really entirely the vision of our first leaders, you know, Jack Gordon and David Abrams and Norman Sherman and now Amy Tushy, our current CEO.
Well, Ken, we're about at the end of our time. It flies by when we're having these wonderful conversations. Those listening to our interviews love to be able to know how they can connect with our guests. And I wonder if people want to connect with you or your work, how might they go about doing that?
Well, probably two ways. They certainly can email me. And email is KNDOK, just five letters. Everyone wants to fill it in. KNDOK at AOL.com. Very early email in the day. Or they can go to my webpage, www, and this is one word, drkendoker.com. So no periods between Dr. Ken Doka.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ken. Really, thank you for being a guest here at Let's Talk Death and for sharing the inspiration behind your path and your book and your work.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much.
If you would like to learn more about Heal Grief, visit us at healgrief.org. To find other conversations or to inquire about becoming a guest speaker, visit us at healgrief.org/Let's Talk Death. And if you feel inspired to support us, remember, no gift is too small. Visit us at healgrief.org/donations, or you can donate right through our homepage. Well, that's it until next time on Let's Talk Death, where we normalize, educate, and demystify the taboo around death, dying, and the journey of grief.